And now, the podcast about movies for people who like movies. Welcome to Snubs.
All right, should we begin?
I guess so. Are you recording right now?
Mm-hmm.
So I guess we should start.
Do you want a countdown?
No. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
100.
99. No.
90.
Come on.
Okay, what do you want me to start? 5?
No.
4?
10 is better.
10. Okay.
9. 8.
Are you warming yourself up? You're amping yourself up?
Let's skip to 5.
5.
4.
3. 2. 1.
Welcome to Snubs. Yes. Welcome back.
Welcome back, everybody. Out there in podcast land, it's only been a week or maybe even just right away.
Yeah.
If we decide to release these all at once, Netflix style.
It's been a lifetime.
It sure has. Man, when was the last time we recorded?
May 9th.
And what is it now?
It is December 14th.
And how many months is that in between?
Ooh, 12 minus 5, carry the 1, 7.
7?
Yeah.
7 months and 5 days.
Yep.
Okay.
Cool. Well, we should get back into it.
My God. That was very convincing, by the way.
Where have we... Okay, I have our little agenda here.
Yeah.
One of the items... We're just going to do this in out of order. Where have we been?
Go for it.
Yeah, I was out of the country basically from May to July.
Where'd
I
you go?
I was in...
This will be cool.
Ooh, what was my route? I think I started in California,
mm-hmm.
and then I was in Toronto,
mm-hmm.
and then Sweden, and then the UK, Amsterdam, then the UK.
Wow.
Then Rwanda, Kenya, Ethiopia, Rwanda, Copenhagen.
You already said Rwanda, Dan.
Yeah, but I went back. I went twice.
Oh.
I'm giving you like the flight legs. And then I came back to New York. No, Budapest. I went to Budapest and then I came back to New York.
Cool. What's Budapest like?
Cool. It's like just like a fun kind of crumbling Eastern European city. It looks like Eastern Promises.
Okay.
That's my frame of reference.
Isn't that like Pennsylvania?
What?
Oh, no, I'm thinking of
Eastern Promises, the
Vigo?
Yeah, Vigo.
Yeah, isn't that Pennsylvania? Doesn't he go to Philly?
Oh. You're talking about A History of Violence.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
And The Eastern Promises is the sequel, right?
Yeah, where he goes to Budapest. Sure. so I've been around a while, and then we both just have had like really crazy schedules.
Oh, this says May 11th. I actually have my calendar open. May 11th, record episode 3 and 4.
Well, we did that.
May 15th.
And then we have our falling out that you don't want to talk about.
No, it's nothing about us. It's great. I mean, we're good. We're cool.
We are cool.
Everyone, don't worry. Snub buds, we're fine.
We also have to celebrate a very important occasion.
What's that?
Which is tomorrow. Which is your birthday.
Oh, yeah.
Happy birthday, Josh.
It's my birthday tomorrow. So, in celebration, I'm having some Swiss Miss uncooked. I'm on the raw.
Yeah, I'm unfortunately a terrible host, and the only thing to eat in my entire apartment
is
one packet of Swiss Miss hot chocolate.
It's good, though.
Yeah, I'm sure the listeners want to hear you swallowing down granules of chocolate.
Oh, you have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been to Detroit.
Okay.
That was a good trip. I've been on a trip with the Dirty Birds that I don't know where it was because I didn't write it down. I guess I could. No, I can't. Can't figure that out. Seattle. Mm-hmm. Out west a lot. Eventually Europe. Florida.
You went to Lebanon for the protests.
I went to Lebanon to participate in the protests. Just kidding. I went there to go to the hotel and the protests were in the way.
Mm.
But I made it.
That doesn't sound very supportive.
I went to Cairo. I was into it. It was cool. Mm. I mean, I was pretty happy to see a bunch of people out in the street. It's very different than the protests in the United States.
Yeah.
Where we're cordoned off and the banks stay open and the schools stay open and there's no fires.
Yeah.
And the president does not resign at the end of it.
Yeah.
That's the difference.
There's no real protests without some tire fires, in my experience.
I think that's true. Yeah. San Antonio, more recently. And, you know, that pretty much brings us up to date. Vermont.
Yeah.
Went all over the place.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to schedule because Dan travels a ton and goes away for little chunks at a time, as well as longer chunks. And I go away for longer chunks as well as littler chunks. And
yeah.
It's just hard to schedule, you guys. It's no big deal. Yeah. Everything's fine.
For the people who are listening literally back to back, I'm sure that they have enjoyed this this detour.
Right, because it's silly. Well, actually, when we started the first episode, we said, like, all right, it's been 2 weeks since the last one dropped. Mm-hmm. And that has not been true, because it'll probably be about a year by the time we release this.
That's true. I hope that we end up doing more than one season a year. But also life, very tricky.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, everyone knows that.
Yeah.
And that's not what they want to hear about. That's not why they tune in.
We should talk about something else.
Why do they tune in?
What is Snubs?
Exactly.
Okay, I have to do this.
Yes, it's your job.
Snubs is a podcast about the Oscars. And it presupposes the question, what if the Best Popular Film Oscar, which never actually saw the light of day, had existed in years past, and we debate what would have been nominated and what would have won. And so we are doing our second season, which is 1984.
Right.
We have done four episodes so far. We did Beverly Hills Cop versus Terminator. We did Romancing the Stone versus Karate Kid.
Ooh.
Did Gremlins versus Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
We did Dune versus Purple Rain.
Ooh.
And now today is Splash versus Temple of Doom.
That's right. We watched two great movies. Movies which we are going to be happy to talk about, unlike the last episode.
Yeah, we watched two very strange movies.
And I asked Dan before we started this, were we too hard on Purple Rain? Were we too hard on Dune?
Mm.
And that's, you know, something I've been thinking about a lot. We kind of, we said both of those movies lost.
Yeah, what was my answer?
Dan's answer was, nope, we were not too hard on them. They were bad.
Yeah, agreed.
you agree with you.
I agreed with myself.
You know, it's fine. It's just that there are some big fans of each of those movies out there.
Name one big fan of either of those movies.
I don't know anybody's... I don't see other people, so... I don't know anyone. I just assume there are big fans of
anybody. If you can't name anybody, and I can't name anybody, and we know that only two people listen to this podcast,
I guess if anybody out there is liking, you know, one of those movies and is kind of mad at us, but not mad enough at us that they didn't listen to the next episode, maybe just go back and watch those movies and see if we had, you know, some good points about why maybe they are bad.
Send us a note and tell us what you think. We have a Gmail address. It's snubspodcast@gmail.com.
You know how to find us.
Literally no one has ever emailed that address, except, do you know the one email we got?
What was that?
It was the email turning down my accreditation for the Cannes Film Festival.
Okay, I'm going to bleep everything except for the email and Cannes Film Festival.
Okay, great.
Yeah, because, you know, that is one of our major sponsors, the Cannes Film Festival. And
oh, that's right.
One of our minor sponsors, to be honest with you. They don't really dish it out the way I'd like them to.
Yeah.
But obviously they invited us.
Yeah, it's weird that they're a medium sponsor and they roundly denied my accreditation.
Again, I'm going to have to bleep that out.
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah, they're fine.
Who are our other sponsors for this episode? Are we going to do some...
Well, we didn't get any sponsorships for this episode, but we do have a little podcast to plug.
Okay.
But we'll wait for the ad break until we actually get there.
Okay.
We could take a break now.
Oh, okay. What's the break? Are you going to plug the thing?
No. We'll just take a break.
Oh. Oh, and we're back.
Good.
Sorry. Getting back into the swing of things. Forgot all of the bits.
But I think we should start talking about movies.
Yeah, we should. We should talk about Temple of Doom and Splash. The one thing I would say is for the first movies that we've done, so our finalists are Terminator, Karate Kid, Ghostbusters. We eliminated both Dune and Purple Rain, and then we will pick one of these.
Yeah, and that'll be it for this season, other than, you know, a potential bonus episode and our finale.
Yep. I think that I made a point in the first episode that at the time I was a little bit disappointed in myself because I didn't think that it was particularly insightful. And the point was that movies just used to be worse. But now that we've seen all these movies, I think that that was true.
But we enjoyed these movies, right? I mean, I did.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I enjoyed both of them in a very kind of curious anthropological way.
There are things about Temple of Doom as an action movie and as a, I guess, would you call it a thriller? Not really a thriller, but it has tension in a way that other action movies of today definitely don't.
That's true. I think you're right on that point. It's very, like, propulsive, despite the fact that it's very problematic. So do you want to talk about the development of of film?
I guess so. And it should be said that I already did, but we lost it all. So I guess if it sounds like I'm, you know, better than usual, it's because I had some practice this time. All right. So anyway, here's the movie. It was produced by George Lucas, directed by Steven Spielberg. Spielberg had just come off of a big win in 1984. He had just directed a movie. What was it?
Spielberg?
Yeah.
What did he direct in 1984?
Well, it's like everything he was directing was doing well at that time.
I to be honest, I don't know.
You know, I really wish I hadn't said that this would be better before starting.
Well, it's better to not set your audience expectations so high. I think that when you should know that from all the podcasting classes that you teach.
All right, Steven Spielberg, you know him. He's good. I mean, Have you seen the documentary on Steven Spielberg?
So it's going to be hard to remember what we talked about or what we didn't talk about, but we'll just pretend that it's all afresh. So,
E.T.
He's coming off. So Raiders of the Lost Ark was 81. I guess his first, you know, he hit the scene with Jaws in 75, and then he made Close Encounters in 77. 1941 is not a movie that I have ever seen, I don't think, and it's not one of his more popular ones. And then Raiders of the Lost Ark comes in 81 and E.T. in 82, which is like a crazy
Raiders
stretch.
Of the Lost Ark a little bit saved his career, if I recall from the
After
HBO
from
documentary. Yeah, 1941 was like a goofy...
Oh, that's right. That's what you asked me. I have not seen the HBO documentary on Steven Spielberg, but I will add it to my watch list.
Okay, great.
But by the time that he's coming into 1984, I guess that he's sort of like recovered from the 1941 bump a little bit, but... He's in a tough place in his personal life.
Yeah, he did Raiders, he did E.T., and the thing was, George Lucas had told his writers, who, you know, first of all, Lawrence Kasdan turned him down. Kasdan had worked with him on Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, but was quoted as saying, I didn't want to touch this movie with a 10-foot pole. Mm. It was dark, it was gloomy, and, you know, really horrible.
Mm.
And he actually said that Spielberg and Lucas were probably going through a tough time in their lives.
Yeah.
And they admitted that they had both been through some relationship trouble, been divorced or, you know, broken up with or whatever. But the thing was, Lucas went to his new screenwriters, Willard Hoik and Gloria Katz, screenwriting team who had worked on American Graffiti. And would work on Howard the Duck afterwards. Good pedigree right there. He said, we need to really rush this script out because we need to keep Steven. And if we don't get him soon, then he's going to go.
Yeah.
And
I love that factoid. The screenwriters behind American Graffiti, which is a good movie, wrote Howard the Duck.
And this movie, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Yeah. But Howard the Duck in particular.
So in that order, what do you think? Do you think their quality went from good to bad or jumped around?
Yeah.
I think that's sort of
I think maybe sometimes you just get one idea.
Well, the development process seemed to be, you know, spend a few days at Skywalker Ranch, talk to...
Did he have the ranch at this point?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Well, yeah, the three movies had come out. He was a multi-billionaire at that time.
He was a multi-billionaire by the time of 1983?
Yeah, he was.
That's insane.
I didn't look it up.
Okay.
But in today's dollars, absolutely, he was a multi-billionaire, or at least in future dollars.
Inflation, but okay.
Yeah, I mean, at least millions. And okay. What's the difference between millions and billions, really?
It's not much.
No, zeros, a couple zeros.
But this was developed at Skywalker Ranch.
Yeah, basically, you come over Skywalker Ranch for a few days, you talk about it with Georgie and Stevie, you get to know sort of what their mind is about, and by all accounts, they're pretty much just, you know, oversized children, leading to a lot of the sort of gross out comedy in this film. One of the things that was interesting is, you know, for any plot development moment, they came up with a way to keep it moving, and those were usually with sort of gross food references, like eating snakes or eating bugs or whatever.
Yeah.
But I'm telling you, it works because the movie never lags, even when they're getting through the weird plot stuff. They're always cutting back to Willie and Short Round eating something funny or complaining about an elephant.
I mean, it's most... So, the thing is, it's weird how much this movie is a gross-out comedy that's not that funny.
Hmm.
You know? Because there's think, four sequences off the top of my head that I could name. So there's the sequence around the campfire where Kate Capshaw is like running into various wild animals who are all kind of spooky and scary.
Great scene. Well, Indy and Shorty are playing poker and both cheating.
Yes. There's the dinner where they serve beetles and a dead snake with live snakes that living inside of it.
Snake surprise.
A snake surprise. Yeah. Yes. It's a new American dish, I think. And then there's the scene where Kate Capshaw's like in the midst of all the bugs, and then there's all the sort of ripping out the heart stuff. It does feel like it is a movie that comes from a very dark and weird place.
Yeah.
Because it is not gross out stuff that's played for laughs. It's like, in many ways, kind of deeply disturbing. And my remark to you when we were watching it was that if you remade this today, it feels a lot more like a Rob Zombie movie than anything else.
I get that, but you're also very sensitive to gross out stuff, Dan. Whereas that's to me, true. I'm kind of...
I don't like gross stuff.
I don't know that this would even be considered violent today.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's not... You don't often see somebody rip a heart out of a chest.
Yeah, with the exception of that one thing, which is horrifying, and I'm going to have nightmares for sure.
Yeah.
But anyway, that seemed to be their MO, is we tell a story that does not let up, and whenever we need plot development, we have to have something funny or silly or gross. And there you have it. Temple of Doom was created thusly. So they had some production issues. Obviously, did I say this already in this taping or the last one?
I'm not sure. You can say it again if we can always cut it out. Or you can always cut it out. Yeah. I don't know how to do that.
I hate editing. Well, so they... I don't think I said this yet, but Willard Hoik, screenwriter... later recalled, at one point when we were writing it, we told George, "We know a lot of Indians. We've been there. I don't think they're going to think that this is really so cool. Do you think you're going to have any trouble shooting there?" George Lucas said, "Are you kidding? It's me and Steve." Months later, they called and said, "We can't shoot in India. They're really upset." So they shot in Sri Lanka and London, mostly. Oof. Why do you think India was upset, Dan?
It's a deeply racist film.
It's racist?
Yeah.
Is it really?
Yeah. Yes. It's one of these things where, you know, I think about this a lot, right? Because the further back that you go in film history, the more uncomfortable these things are. Mm-hmm. And this movie would never pass muster today.
Right.
In any way, shape, or form.
Right.
And I wonder sometimes what are our responsibilities as an audience in terms of watching these things, rewatching these things, how should we think about it? How should we let it inform our sort of tastes and thoughts about the things that we see? It was, for me, a very distracting experience because there's sort of two sets of villains in this film, and there's a set of villains in Shanghai, and then there's a set of villains in, I guess, rural India. And they are so maniacally evil.
Mm-hmm.
And it is just like the worst expression of the most damaging kind of orientalist tropes.
Yeah, a lot of cackling.
Mm-hmm, a lot of cackling. They're really shot from below. Their eyes are sunken and hollow. It looks like they put like makeup on half of the actors to sort of emphasize that. And then for the, you know, the quote unquote good villagers in the Sri Lanka scenes, that's like, they're all poor and destitute, and they all want to come and touch Indy at the end and like praise his sort of white saviorship. So
well, to be fair, he is white and he did save them.
Yeah,
I mean, and this is a documentary, yes. So.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, it really happened.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. I don't know where to go with that one.
It's a fictionalized. You want to take a break?
Yeah.
Okay, let's take a break.
Great. And we're back.
All right, yeah.
Sorry, I just had to think about that for a second.
Fair enough. No, I think it's a fictionalized,
it was a recreation
telling
of
a true story, yeah. But Harrison Ford was the main character of the story, not Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
Do we need to take another break?
No. I just
had to get that in.
I'm wondering whether I should say the thing about this being a Samuel Beckett play again.
love making references to deleted things that did not get recorded.
Yeah. I think that it is a very kind of distracting experience in that regard, and it's something that the screenwriters at least were noted, at least in their kind of rendering of the script, but it doesn't really feel like they got around that in any way. And it certainly is of a piece, I think, with some of the uncomfortable racial stereotyping that happens in the Star Wars movies in particular.
Yeah, for sure.
It feels very much like a George Lucas thing.
He's a little tone deaf.
Yeah.
He's a lot tone deaf.
The other thing that I thought about when I saw that, I mean, and this was talked about on the original Blank Check podcast when they were still doing the Star Wars ones, but also at the George Lucas talk show, which I've been to, which is a stand-up show in the East Village. But when he was selling the Star Wars properties to Disney, do you remember what he said? He said, "It feels like I'm selling my children to white slavers."
That's kind of fucked up.
Yeah. So anyway, very problematic film in a lot of ways. And it feels like the problematic pieces of it, at least in my mind, come from that sort of Lucas ethos. And then the more fun elements and the more kind of propulsive action elements come from this Spielberg part of it.
Yep, I agree with that. What is Spielberg good at? He's good at keeping us interested. He's good at using the camera in ways where there's always something new to be seen, focusing on the foreground, focusing on the background. He's good at cutting back and forth between, as I said before, sort of like plot stuff and tension building stuff. Good director. Mm-hmm. He's also really great with kids, I got to say. That's always been his thing for me.
Yeah.
And what doesn't work when other directors try and work with kids is that they're not Steven Spielberg.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's a lot of problems just sort of in terms of the concept of the character of Short Round.
Yeah.
But I don't know what that actor's name is, but I love that kid. He was in the Goonies as
Jonathan
well.
Jonathan Kwan.
Okay. Love that kid. And he's like the MVP of the movie. He's always saving the day.
I mean, Indiana Jones is the MVP of the movie.
Yeah,
he's always saving the day.
I don't know.
He is.
He's mostly getting brainwashed.
He gets brainwashed for a while.
Yeah.
And you're right. Jonathan Kwan does save the movie.
And then he's mostly getting stabbed by a voodoo doll.
Kwan saved. You're right. Yeah. Okay, he's saving the day in some moments when we really need him.
Okay. So for those of you following along at home, this is now the third time that we're trying to record this because the computer keeps dumping the last 2 minutes. But I think that I was just about to ask you to run down the plot.
Okay, let's do it. I will now run down the plot.
Great.
So we open with a musical number in Shanghai.
Yep.
Indiana Jones appears wearing a white tuxedo, very James Bond, mm-hmm. very cool. He sits across the table from some evil, maniacal Chinese men who threaten him with his life. He immediately says, "No, I have the upper hand." Then they do, then he does. And they use a Lazy Susan very tastefully, I would say.
Yeah.
One of the best dinner appliances known to me, anyway.
Yeah, I don't know why we don't have those. Don't use those more often.
We could just use one. We could just get one. We could honestly. We could.
There's nothing stopping us. I'll look on Amazon
about Lazy Susan. Yeah, go get one. So eventually, Indiana Jones is poisoned, and he has taken Kate Capshaw hostage. But she also kind of, helps him out. Gets the antidote and the diamond that they were looking for, and they escape with Indy's friend Short Round, an 11-year-old Chinese boy, who is a really great character. Mm-hmm. We talked about it a little bit, I think, before we got cut off. Yeah. But
yeah, I think so, because I just heard that us say that when you played it back.
Okay, good.
It's becoming a very meta episode.
Whew.
What happens afterwards?
So they escape on a plane, but the plane was owned by the Chinese guy, and he instructs his pilot to bail out over the Himalayas and crash the plane.
Mm-hmm.
And Indy, of course, figures out a way to survive through that using a giant flotation device, mm-hmm. big raft, and they go very quickly from sledding down a mountain to rafting on a river in the jungle.
Yep.
This is a thing that happens because of a vertical mountainous... it's hard to believe that there would be snow right before the jungle.
Oh,
but
yes.
But they drop some large amount of feet, and that's why it's realistic.
It's insane. It's the most, like, even the stuff with the pulling out of the heart, at least you're set up to suspend your disbelief for that.
Yes.
This raft scene is the most ridiculous thing, because they fall, 500 feet from a plane...
yeah.
to the slopes of the Himalayas or
and
wherever.
And they're fine.
And then they ski for a while,
yes.
or they snow tube, or whatever you would call it.
It's called sledding. What happened to your childhood?
Yeah, sledding, yes. I don't know. I guess it didn't go sledding that often. And then they shoot off a cliff and fall another 300 feet into water.
Yeah.
And that was the moment where I was like, this is bad. I forgot that this is bad.
Right.
Yeah. It picks up later on.
The movie hadn't convinced you yet how great it is.
It had not.
Not at that moment
Still
yet.
Still hasn't.
Okay, sorry for that noise. But anyway, moving on, they eventually land in a Indian village where the villagers are very happy to see them. The villagers had prayed to Shiva that they would show up and save them and actually really save their kids and the precious stones that had been kidnapped. So they eat some funny bugs or whatever. What are they eating in that scene? Something gross.
Oh, it looks like it's just a rice bowl to me, but I don't know.
Oh, no. It was when they were smiling and...
Yeah, no, I know what you're talking about. I think it was then maybe. It was grape leaves or banana leaves and stuff.
It did kind of look like grape leaves, yeah. Anyway, they eat that stuff and then
Can I interject for a second?
No.
Just so everybody knows, Amazon has a really lovely selection of Lazy Susans.
Oh,
if
wow.
If anybody wants to go.
Great.
Buy one of those.
What price are we looking at?
You have under 25, between 25 and 50, and above 50. If you ever need to negotiate with somebody and pass diamonds and poison antidote and gold coins back and forth.
And Spielberg is just killing it in that scene, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just the way the camera moves with the Susan.
Sure.
I mean, it really makes me wish I had a lazy Susan.
Yeah. All things are possible.
Our sponsor this week is Lazy Susans. I'm not going to go into it.
Okay. Let's keep going.
Anyway, they... They agree to go on this mission to Bangkok Temple, which Indiana Jones had heard was not really in service these days. But they go. They ride some elephants. They go. Kate Capshaw shows us that she does not like elephants. And they get to the palace of the Maharaji, who is a child. And there's sort of like a professor-y guy over there.
He introduces himself as the prime minister of the something something.
Sure. And there's also a British captain, and this was in the 30s when India was still under British colonial rule. It all makes sense, right? It all tracks.
Sure.
So far, everything's realistic, and it's all good. And they basically, you know, eventually they find themselves in the Temple of Doom.
Yeah.
Dan's looking at an empty bottle of beer.
No, it's half full.
Oh, look at that attitude. Nice. Way to go. Very non-Spielberg and Lucas circa 1984.
Yeah, well, I'm not struggling in my personal life right now
in a
similar way.
Congratulations. Mm. That's great.
Yep.
So anyway, they go to the Temple of Doom, and this is where most of the second half of the movie occurs. But up until this moment, it's just been, building tension, release, building tension, release, building tension, release. And then we get to the most disturbing thing that anybody's ever seen. Living or dead in any film that had ever existed.
Is this ripping the heart out of the chest?
Yeah, some guy reaches his hand into some other guy's chest and rips the heart out,
yeah.
holds the heart out, the guy's still alive. Then they, descend him into a fiery lava tube, and he burns.
Yep.
Alive.
True.
And the heart is still there.
Yep.
It's gross.
Yep.
I watched it when I was 5. I had nightmares.
Well, a lot of people remember being quite... scared of this moment when they were kids.
It's scary.
And we haven't said this yet. This is the combination of this and Gremlins, both movies that Steven Spielberg was involved in, led to the PG-13 rating in 1984.
Correct. And Spielberg apparently was the one who suggested it, that there be something between PG and R.
Mm-hmm.
Question is, what would this movie be today?
I think it would be an R.
I think it would be G. Pretty tame, if you ask me.
It's like 5 degrees away from Pixar.
It's a Pixar movie. It would have been animated.
Mm. Yeah, maybe.
Not a lot animated in this film. A lot of actual sets that were built, which
yeah.
is cool. We were pretty appreciative of that.
Well, not a lot happens in the film either. They get to the Temple of Doom. They're grossed out on a number of different occasions by like what they have to eat and what they have to go through. And then it's basically just sort of one...
Indy wants the stones. He had promised them that he would bring them back the stones.
Mm-hmm.
He also wanted them for his own personal fortune.
Yeah.
So he goes and gets them, but they capture him and they capture his two companions. and they force him to drink the blood of, what was the name of the god?
Kalima.
Kalima. So they force him to drink the blood of Kali, which is explained by a pretty good child performance, I have to say. I liked that moment a lot. That kid was crushing it.
Okay.
Another Spielberg, you know, well-coached performance. And he drinks it. He becomes a zombie for a little while and turns against his friends. But then Short Round saves us all by burning Indy in the stomach. Mm-hmm. And he turns back to his regular self and saves the day. And they leave the temple and go outside onto a rope bridge where the last big action sequence happens, and that's it.
Yeah, basically. There's a long sequence in the mines where...
The mine cart.
There's a mine cart chase, and they
You said it was better than what?
Oh, it's better than the mine cart chase in The Rock, which we talked about last season.
Oh, right. That's true. But it's worse than the mine cart chase in Donkey Kong Country.
So I disagree with that a little bit.
You think it's better than Donkey Kong Country?
Oh, I'm sorry. I agree with that completely.
Oh, wow, you just really flip-flopped there.
No, I misinterpreted
running for Congress
what you were
or something?
Saying.
Okay.
Yeah. DKC? Love DKC.
Well, I was watching it. I'm like, this is like a video game. They keep giving us a setup, and then it gets a little more intense, and then I get, you know, the guys in the other cart hitting them with the thingy, and then they jumps in their own cart, and he strangles them, and there's just all these different little setups that they have to do in this little small space, and they do a big jump.
Yep.
It's like they got the idea for Donkey Kong Country from this.
Yeah, and in fairness, in DKC, I don't know, 2 or 3,
mm-hmm.
you got... what are the names? Donkey Kong?
Country.
Diddy Kong.
Oh, Daisy Kong.
Kong. Yeah.
Gramps. That's probably not it. There's a grandpa version.
Yeah,
There's a baby Kong.
This is where art kind of permeates the culture, and these things all influence each other. And you're looking at the computer. Are we still recording?
It seems to be good.
Okay, great. Cool. So what works for you and what doesn't work for you about this movie?
Oh, yeah. Well, I guess I've said it already. The tension that is consistently being ramped up throughout the whole movie is something I really appreciated. I just was comparing it as I was watching it to, you know, the action movies of today, which are pretty much all Marvel movies.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Is that true? I mean, are there other action movies?
I would say that the most successful action movies today are Marvel movies, and then you get, like, other stuff that generally doesn't, like,
doesn't connect work. The same way. Well, but the Marvel movie, the way they do it is there's an action sequence at the beginning, there's a big one in the middle, and then there's a huge one at the end. This movie, it's kind of just action, 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 action. Big action sequence at the end.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's true. I don't know.
It doesn't bother me.
Yeah.
That there's no, you know, explanation of what's happening.
All of the Marvel movies blend together for me, so I think that that's true. But
well, if that's the case, then it's one 22-hour long... Wait, that's not even close to what it really is. We're 70 hour, right?
Yeah. It is that, and it feels that. Feels like that.
You love the Marvel movies.
No.
Yes, you do.
No.
You do. I saw one of them with you, and you liked it.
Because I like a few of them.
There you go. You love them all.
Black Panther is excellent. I love Black Panther. That's my favorite. Mm. The Avengers is really good. And then, what is the... I always get the last two Avengers confused.
Infinity War?
Space Mess. That's Space Mess.
Yeah.
That one I don't like.
You don't like that one. Yeah. I like that one.
And then Endgame.
Endgame's great.
Endgame is actually, I think, a really interesting film. And it takes the story in some extremely meta directions where it rewards sort of the kind of repeat viewership that the MCU has become known for, you know? And I kind of think that that's interesting as like an engagement with fan culture.
Just necessitates it more than rewards it.
And the scene at the end where sort of all of these actors, all of these movie stars are coming together for like the one and only time, probably because of scheduling issues.
Yes.
To be in the same place and sort of have the final battle. That's very rousing and kind of works. It's like a satisfying capstone to a bunch of movies that I think are fine.
Okay, so this has been Dan's Marvel Corner.
Yeah. Oh, I have a lot more thoughts on Marvel. We could do a whole like side thing on that, but that's fine. We don't need to. So you like Temple of Doom?
Yeah, I like it. I mean, yeah, Kate Capshaw gets kind of lost, and I think she said it. There, I wanted to share some of the critical review.
We should say also this was wildly successful. So it was the number 3 movie of the year.
It was the number 3 movie of the year. It was the biggest opening weekend of the year. It was at the time the 10th highest grossing film of all time.
Mm-hmm.
which is pretty awesome.
It's interesting that so the top three are Beverly Hills Cop, then Ghostbusters, then Indiana Jones. And I could not possibly imagine a situation today where the number one movie of the year was a studio comedy, and the number three movie of the year was a movie like this. It would definitely be switched places.
It's a good point. Yeah. Beverly Hills Cop was just such a freaking phenomenon.
Yeah, I guess so. Great.
No, not amazing, but, you know, did not win. It did win.
The kind of, like, the underlying secret of this season is that none of these movies are great.
Hey, listen, it was 1984. They were doing their best. It wasn't the 70s. It wasn't the 90s. Mm-hmm. It was the 80s. And, guys, not a lot of good came out of that. So, critical response. Roger Ebert gave the film a perfect 4-star rating, calling it the most cheerfully exciting, bizarre, goofy, romantic adventure movie since Raiders. And it is high praise to say that it's not so much a sequel as an equal. Nice! Way to go, Ebes.
That is delightful.
Vincent Canby felt the film was too shapeless to be the fun that Raiders is, but shape may be beside the point. Old-time 15-part movie serials didn't have shape. They just went on and on, which is what Temple of Doom does with humor and technical invention. Good. I like that review. Let me skip through here. One of the most sheerly pleasurable physical comedies ever made. Dave Kerr gave a largely negative review. The film betrays no human impulse higher than that of a 10-year-old boy trying to gross out his baby sister by dangling a dead worm in her face.
I would agree with that.
And this is going to be your favorite. The ads say this film may be too intense for younger children are fraudulent. No parent should allow a young child to see this traumatizing movie. It would be a cinematic form of child abuse. Even Harrison Ford is required to slap Kwan and abuse Capshaw. There are no heroes connected with the film, only two villains. Their names are Steven Spielberg and George Lucas. That's pretty scathing, right?
That is scathing, Ralph but also Novak. Seconded. I think that's right.
Yeah, it's probably true. It's not so bad. I mean, yes, it's really rough for young kids. I can attest to that because I was one of them.
Cool. What else do you want to say about Temple of Doom?
What else do I want to say? Elephant, good joke. Elephant spraying a room with water at the end, good joke. Also, the funniest moment was when someone gets bunked on the head.
It's high art.
They're using a voodoo doll at one point, which
there's a lot
I don't
of people
think...
that get bunked on the head.
No, well, this one person really gets it though. That's funny.
Okay.
How about you? What do you want to say about Temple of Doom? Anything?
I think that I've kind of alluded to the fact that this is not a movie that I really like. It feels like there's sort of... It feels to me like it's a movie that's not at peace with itself in some ways, because I think that in some ways it's really trying to be a very kind of fun action-adventure, and then in other ways it feels like a very sort of... ugly racist piece of cinema.
It's
ugly
dark.
And racist and violent, you know. And I think that, you know, it's not something I would ever like. I was happy to watch it again for this because I think it's interesting. It's not something that I would ever seek out again. The question that I have in my mind, not having seen the other Indiana Jones films in some time, is whether they all have the same tone and tenor and I'm just kind of misremembering it, or whether Raiders of the Lost Ark and The Last Crusade are fundamentally different.
Well, look, the villains are Nazis in those movies. Mm-hmm. It's easier to paint Nazis as villainous, comically
them,
villainous.
Even in, what is it called?
Crystal Skull.
Yeah, The Legend of the Crystal Skull.
They do well when they go to Nazis. That's the thing. They're easier to paint as villains
they do well
than
when
just
they go to
a
Nazis.
Chinese
they
person.
They do less well when they go to aliens. That movie kind of went off the rails a little bit.
Spoilers. That's a spoiler.
Yeah, that's a spoiler.
That didn't show up in the first.
I kind of secretly like that movie because I think that the Cate Blanchett gives a really interesting performance in that movie.
I just wanted to say before we move on, some of the film's cast and crew, including Spielberg, retrospectively view the film in a negative light, partly to the film being the darkest and most overtly violent Indiana Jones film. That's definitely true. There's violence. This is a heart being pulled out.
Yep.
There's fire. People burning up. But Lucas and Spielberg attributed the film's darkness to their relationship problems, Lucas's divorce from Marcia. Mm-hmm. Lucas, I was right when I said Marcia.
Right, yeah.
And Spielberg's breakup with Amy Irving. Cate Capshaw recalled her character as not much more than a dumb, screaming blonde. Probably this was the character that was written by two men who were kind of bruised by the women leaving them, women in their lives leaving
well,
them.
Well, that makes it sound a little bit like it's not their fault.
What do you mean it's not their fault? They're the ones who wrote the movie.
No, no, no. It makes it sound like we should blame the women in their life who left them.
Oh, I didn't mean that.
Yeah. No, I know you didn't mean that. I'm just saying that I think all too often we get this sort of idea of the brooding artist who is hurting in his personal life, and then that is sort of excused for the art that they make. I think they should view some of this stuff in a negative light. It's not good. It's not a great movie. I think that in many ways, well, we've talked about some movies this season that I actually really genuinely dislike, and so I would probably put this above, like, Dune and Purple Rain in terms of watchability, but it's certainly less so than most of the other things we've discussed.
It's true. Well, Spielberg agrees with you. He says Temple of Doom is my least favorite of the trilogy. He looks back and says the greatest thing he got out of it was that he met Kate Capshaw. So,
well, that's sweet.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah,
that's nice of him to say. He didn't really give her a good part, but he did marry her.
Okay. Cool. All right, should we talk about Splash?
Yeah, let's do it. I'm excited. I've been looking forward to this.
Okay. I guess let me start with a little bit of sort of personal context. So this is the 10th highest grossing movie of 1984.
Correct.
So it was relatively popular. But I didn't pick this movie because I think it deserves to be best popular film of 1984. I picked it because it has a very sort of special personal connection to my own life, which is that my mother was seeing this movie in the theaters when she went into labor with me in March of 1984.
Did everybody get that? This movie is the reason why Dan was born.
In a way.
Because without Tom Hanks on that screen, larger than life, probably there wouldn't have been a birth.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know.
That's taking it to a little bit of a dark place.
It's also probably not true.
Probably not true.
I'm sure you would have been born.
Anyway, I heard about this when I was growing up, and so this movie has always held a little bit of a special place in
my heart.
Did
you like it when you were a kid?
I loved it when I was a kid. I think now it's weird, but okay.
High praise from Dan Gwinnell, everybody. Weird, but okay. That's probably the best you'll get.
No, but it's weird in the way that all of these other movies are weird. They're a product of a very specific time and place that in some ways is like barely recognizable to where we are now.
True. I agree with that because it does feel like another world.
Yeah.
No, I'm not even talking about Atlantis in the credits. I'm talking about New York. It doesn't feel real.
Yeah. No, but I mean, you see things like, and there's a bunch of movies like this in the 80s, you know, fish out of water movies, you could say.
That's really funny.
Mm-hmm.
Good joke.
I stole your joke.
Yeah, no, that's fine. You can take it.
But there's, when I think about
this, it was mine.
There's Moscow on the Hudson, there's Coming to America, etc. There are all these movies that show New York in a very different light that just feels completely different.
Brianna pointed out when we were watching Splash, she saw it a lot as a kid. I had never seen it before. Mm-hmm. But she loved it. It was one of her, you know, VCR movies. Mm-hmm. And basically she said that this was what I knew of New York, was like that scene when the cab either stops or doesn't. I don't remember. It's been a few weeks since I watched it. Et cetera. Other stuff in New York.
Yeah, there is a taxi.
There's a taxi, at least one.
Yeah, at least one.
Yeah.
So I guess maybe just a little bit of context on what this movie is and kind of where it came from. So this is a Ron Howard movie. And it's one of his earlier movies. So this was, he had made a couple of things that were sort of very low budget, not very well known. And then his first kind of larger movie was Night Shift in 82. Did you ever see that?
Mm-mm.
It's Henry Winkler and Michael Keaton and Shelley Long.
Cool.
And it has a bizarre premise, which is that it's about a night shift worker in a morgue who decides to start using the space to run a ring of sex workers.
Amazing.
Yep.
Brilliant.
I haven't seen that in a while. I bet that would be problematic. But in any case, this was like his first...
Only because of, you know, dead people and sex workers, right? Well, why else do you think it would be problematic?
No, just those reasons are enough.
Okay, got it.
Yeah. So it's kind of very early for him, and he's a director that I really like earlier in his career. So he made Cocoon...
Great.
He made Willow, he made Parenthood, he made Apollo 13. He made these movies that, to be honest, I haven't seen most of them in a really long time, but they're very kind of like formative movies of my childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And then more recently, he's made a bunch of things that I really just genuinely dislike, like the Dan Brown adaptations and Solo, A Star Wars Story, which is such a snooze. Mm. But this is early in his career, and then he knew Tom Hanks... Because before he started directing, he was playing Richie Cunningham on Happy Days. And Tom Hanks was like a guest star in 1981 or 1982 or something like that.
Oh, cool.
And so that's how Tom Hanks got this role, and it's actually his first lead role in a movie.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
He did a good job.
Yeah. Yeah, he's great. And I mean, you can sort of get a sense of the kind of comedic actor that he would go on to be, mm-hmm. not yet a sense of the dramatic actor that he would become.
No, this is pre that thing you do, everybody. So this is the pre TTYD Hanks.
Yeah, yes, very pre. But then he goes on after this to make Bachelor Party, Volunteers, and The Money Pit, like all the kind of slapsticky Tom Hanks comedies that you get kind of in the 80s. Before he starts going on his Oscar run.
But where did he come from? He was in Bosom Buddies, right? I've never seen that show.
He was in Bosom Buddies at the time. He had done like one low-budget horror movie.
Oh, really?
He was in some TV movie or whatever. But this is his first real like leading role.
Cool.
Hanks.
We love him.
So we got Ron Howard. We got Tom Hanks. We got Daryl Hannah, who is, I guess, a little bit famous already because she was in Blade Runner in 1982.
Was that her first film?
No, she was in a couple things before that. I think her first film was a movie called Fury. Huh. Early in her career,
Nick Fury biopic.
Nick Fury biopic.
She played the eye patch.
Going back to the MCU. She was very popular in the 80s, and then she kind of like vanished in the 90s and resurfaced in the 2000s when she was in Kill Bill and was doing a bunch of other things. And then you have two great comedic actors, so John Candy and Eugene Levy. Mm. John Candy is an actor for me that like I always sort of kind of have liked him when he's popped up in things. And I love Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know a ton about him and a ton about his career. And he's not like in this movie very much. It's sort of very much kind of a supporting slapsticky kind of performance.
Yeah, you could have had the whole movie without him. And then they just put him in for a few scenes. Exactly.
And then the weird thing is Eugene Levy in this. Because I think of Eugene Levy as this very sort of like fussy, quiet comedic actor, which is what his kind of performances have become.
Yeah.
And this is just him shouting and screaming. Yeah,
going all out.
In kind of like an unpleasant way.
You didn't like it.
No, I didn't really like it. But that's the sort of people who are involved in the making of this. As far as the plot, it's pretty simple. So Tom Hanks, or child Tom Hanks, is on vacation in Cape Cod. Mm-hmm. When he was a kid, he sees something in the water when he's on a ferry. He jumps in. And it's the child version of Daryl Hannah. They have like a moment, and then he's rescued, and he grows up and he lives his life. He runs a produce business in New York, unlucky in love, and there's a moment where he decides to go back to Cape Cod, goes back to Cape Cod, bonks his head, he falls off of a boat and bonks his head.
Yes.
Daryl Hannah saves him.
Yes.
And then finds his wallet, and so she knows to come to New York. And then the big, like the sort of very long protracted second act is Daryl Hannah finds him in New York, and it's the fish out of water stuff. It's, oh, she doesn't speak any English, but she still knew to go to Bloomingdale's and like this and that and the other thing. And
she learns English from watching TV.
She learns
which
English.
Which is fun.
They fall in love, and I'm putting that in air quotes.
Huge air quotes.
Yeah,
from
huge air quotes. But they, I guess you would, a more accurate way of saying it would be that they become each other's romantic leads for the remainder of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, she's obsessed with him.
Yep.
And then he is obsessed with her.
Mm-hmm.
And then they fight, and then they get back together.
Yeah, that's basically it. There's not... It's mostly kind of comedic set pieces about how she eats seafood in a funny way and whatever else.
I loved that scene.
Eugene Levy comes back in. He's trying to, like... He's trying to get blonde women in New York wet because he thinks that will turn them into mermaids. Or he thinks that will expose the mermaids, rather.
He doesn't just think it. He knows it. And
he does know it, and it is true. And he finally wets Daryl Hannah, and the world discovers the existence of mermaids.
Right.
And then she's captured and taken to, like, a lab that is weirdly in the American Museum of Natural History.
Oh, yeah, right.
And then the last, like, 20 minutes of the movie is they go and rescue her. And then the kind of crux of it, the emotional kind of finale of the film is that they get to the East River or wherever, and Tom Hanks has to decide whether to go with her and live underwater and
become a merman.
Yeah, and become a merman.
In Atlantis.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right.
I have some questions.
Great, and then I have a couple of fun facts.
Oh, okay, good. So,
no, go with your questions.
Question one, how great is Daryl Hannah in this movie? I think very.
Yeah.
She's charming as all get out.
Yeah.
As the fish out of water. Yeah. When she's eating the lobster.
Yeah.
How adorable is that?
Yeah.
She takes a bite of the shell of it.
It was very, apparently very traumatic for her to film that because she was I think she's a vegan now and was a vegetarian at the time. And so they had to mash up potatoes and hearts of palm and empty out a lobster shell and put that in. So she's not actually eating lobster in that scene.
But she is eating the shell of a living lobster. It's not like the lobster could be alive.
I know.
I mean, I would say enjoy the lobster at that point. Also, when she starts to adore the present that Tom Hanks gives her while it's still in the box because she doesn't know how to unwrap it.
She thinks it's a box.
It's beautiful. Another question. How are Tom Hanks and John Candy the wealthiest produce suppliers in the world?
How do you figure? How are they the wealthiest produce suppliers in the world?
I mean, they are invited to a dinner with the president.
Oh, yeah, that's going on. Track.
Like, there's more than that that I don't recall. I just remember that they are insanely wealthy.
Well, Tom Hanks does have a really nice apartment, but I think that was easier to do in the 80s.
Right, that's true.
Yeah.
Also, John Candy has like a red Corvette or something like
that. Yeah, that's true. It is weird, though, that there is a scene where John Candy's like, hey, do you want to go to this ball with the President of the United States?
And the President does like a 5-minute stand-up routine. What's going on? Like, he's the President.
I don't know.
A roast.
Yeah, it's weird.
That's what I'm saying. It's like a whole other world. It doesn't actually exist.
Yeah.
Where these like produce guys are like invited to dinners with the President for no reason.
It's an extremely thinly written film that was somehow nominated for Best Original Screenplay.
Really? I didn't actually know that. That's amazing.
Yep, it's true. It lost to Places in the Heart, which is the Sally Field movie about the Depression.
Final question. I have not prepped Dan for this. Dan?
Yeah.
Who is your favorite character in this movie?
Oh, I don't know. I guess I'll go with Madison.
No. Dig a little deeper.
Dig a little
deeper.
Not one of the leads.
There's someone in here that's a very, I would say, endearing, you could say.
Is it the secretary?
It is the secretary.
Okay.
Why is that your favorite character in the movie?
She's not. Why do you think that she should be my favorite character?
She's the oldest woman in the movie.
Okay. Yes. I do like grandmas in movies.
Okay, so that didn't work very well. But you guys, I'm going to cut all that out.
Okay.
Dan, who's your favorite character in the movie?
Oh, the secretary.
Funny.
Yeah, funny. It was funny that she can't remember anything and she wears a top on the outside of her shirt, I guess. I don't know. Best original screenplay, folks.
I can also say that I think Eugene Levy is the only character that actually has an arc in this movie.
That's true.
He might start off as a screaming, angry man, but...
That's true. He has a sort of soulful moment where he sees her in the tank and he regrets his actions.
He's got to question whether it's all been worth it.
Yeah.
Also, why does the other scientist at that moment, when Eugene Levy tries to sort of horn his way into the lab, why does the other scientist say, go find a unicorn or something? He's making fun of the fact that the guy found a mermaid, but he is testing that very mermaid.
Yep.
What this dude, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Give the guy some credit. He found a mermaid.
Yeah.
In reality.
The movie is not good.
I just didn't think the movie doesn't really want to believe in what's happening on screen in the movie.
Yeah,
the movie doesn't take itself seriously.
Yeah. I think that's right. But it's just sort of a loosely organized string of scenes that all have like one kind of central amusing joke, like the eating of the lobster or whatever.
That's great
kind
joke.
Of all it is.
Yeah.
But it's fine, and if it was that easy to get an Oscar in 1984, then good for everybody involved. there's a couple things about this movie that are interesting. So, and I read this, and you also brought this up before we started recording. This is the movie that popularized the name Madison for girls, because there's a scene where Tom Hanks and Daryl Hannah are walking along Madison Avenue, and they say, we need to give you a name, and she picks Madison. Mm-hmm.
And then he says, no, that's not a name. And then he says, I mean, if you want to be Madison.
And now it's a name.
That's great.
So there was a sequel, Splash 2.
Ah, really?
Where none of the original actors return except for the secretary.
Dodie?
Yeah.
Dodie Goodman, that's her name.
Okay, yeah, Dodie Goodman comes back. But anyway, it kind of erases the emotional stakes of the last act of the film because Tom Hanks and Daryl Hannah just come back because they want to visit John Candy.
Right.
And they
Which
hang
is the one
on
thing they say they
while.
Can't really do.
And then it's something about the produce business, and the guy who is going to be their buyer also owns an aquarium, and the aquarium has a dolphin that's Daryl Hannah's friend, and they have to free the dolphin. I don't know. I read the Wikipedia, and it seems...
Wow. And it did well?
No.
Oh.
It's like a direct-to-TV movie.
Daryl Hannah's not in it?
No. None of the people are in it. I'm using the names of the actors because I don't remember who was actually in it. It
sounds like a horrible movie.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. And then, so the fun thing about this is that this is the first movie that was released by Touchstone Pictures.
Huh.
Which was set up by Disney to make adult projects that would not necessarily fit in with their brand.
Right.
So they made a lot of movies in the 80s and 90s, but like Splash, Down and Out in Beverly Hills, Color of Money, Adventures in Babysitting, Three Men and a Baby, Good Morning Vietnam, like a lot of different things that you would recognize. I think that that's mostly it in terms of the context. And so let me ask you this. What works for you about this and what doesn't?
Oh, I mean, I already said it. Daryl Hannah is adorable. She does great. Fish out of water stuff. Tom Hanks. This movie gave us Tom Hanks. The Hanks that we know and love.
Yep.
Hanks at Hanks.com.
Yep.
He, you know, he shows his acting chops. He shows his yelling chops. He does not play the part at the end where he's sort of like doggedly, obsessively saying, like, we're getting married, I don't need to know what your surprise is. Mm-hmm. Very well.
Yeah.
I don't buy that he doesn't, you know, want to know what her big surprise is. Mm-hmm. But that's okay.
I think he has become, well, I think he became, and you could debate whether or not he still is, a truly great actor. And I think one of the interesting things about this movie as I was watching it is seeing him kind of like test out the boundaries of what his performances look
mm-hmm.
like.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so I mean, what works for me about it is I actually just like all of the actors that are in the movie. And I think that they've all gone on to do interesting things in other movies that I really liked after this.
Yeah.
And obviously there's just the sort of historical legacy of like, this was a big break for Ron Howard. This is a big break for Tom Hanks. This is a big break for Touchstone Pictures. And so all that stuff is great. I don't really like or not like anything about this movie in any great degree. I think it's kind of fine.
It's watchable.
Yeah. The thing that I like most about it is completely metatextual, which is that I like the story because it was involved in the night of my birth.
That's fair.
Yeah.
What do you think about the technical work on this film?
Oh, that's right. We didn't talk about that.
No, I think
so
it's
that's
worth
right.
mentioning.
That's worth mentioning. It is actually quite remarkable, some of the underwater stuff that they did. And in particular, for that period of time when we were both respectively watching it, I think that we were both thinking, wow, it's impressive that they were able to do the prosthetic with the fin, that Daryl Hannah was able to swim convincingly underwater with it, that they were able to do like all these scenes down on like the reef and whatever. It's cool. That stuff is great.
Yeah, it's all pretty seamless.
Yeah.
I mean, there are no scenes where you see anybody holding their breath.
Yeah. And Ron Howard, like, that's good practice for him, right? Like, there's things like, you know, Apollo 13 and Willow and Cocoon that are pretty effects heavy.
Mm-hmm.
This is probably a little bit of a test front for him.
Yeah, and, you know, it's effects. Would you call this effects? These effects? I mean, a lot of it's just like, how do you get Daryl Hannah to agree to spend, you know, weeks and weeks in the water
yeah.
while she films this thing?
Well, in 1984, that was a visual effect.
I guess you're right.
Yeah. So, I guess to sort of wrap up a little bit, which do you think we should move on to the final round?
Look, I mean, Temple of Doom had the bigger box office draw. It has it's the second in a long-running franchise. The Splash sequel went nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Splash. I think that as far as popularity goes,
mm-hmm.
you got Temple of Doom every time. However, on the other hand, it is the least favorite for a lot of people, including its director,
yeah,
and actors of the indie franchise.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know. Kind of goes both ways. Temple of Doom has more to like and more to hate. Yeah. Splash, as you said, is more of just a comforty, fluffy thing.
I think Splash, in a lot of ways, is actually like a better film. Because it's... Temple of Doom, I think to say that it has more to like and more to hate is exactly kind of right on the nose. Because it is a movie of extremes. Yeah. Because some of the visual effects stuff, some of the action choreography, it's all like real good.
Mm.
And then when it's bad, it's really bad and really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Whereas Splash, there is, I mean, we haven't really talked about it, there's some problematic stuff in that too, in the relationship between Tom Hanks and Daryl Hannah. But it's
because she's
largely
a mermaid.
Yeah, because she's a mermaid. You know
and
how I feel about
he's
that.
He's a human.
Yeah.
Yeah, Dan has real issues with interspecies dating, you guys.
But largely, it's not particularly offensive, and certainly not in the way that the Temple of Doom is.
No.
It's hard. You know, I think for the metrics that we've outlined in terms of the longevity of the thing, the popularity of the thing, the box office success of the thing, Temple of Doom kind of wins the round. Although I say that kind of grudgingly because it's the movie that I like much less.
Fair enough. Well, listen, I mean, you got to look at the director's intentions when making each of these movies. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Splash is kind of a fantasy film, and so is Temple of Doom. But one of them has a really optimistic viewpoint, and one of them has a really pessimistic viewpoint. One of them is delightful and fun, and one of them is kind of gory and intense. Yep. And obviously, Splash is the gory, intense movie that I'm talking about.
Yep. So I think that's it. Can you pause it for a second?
Yes. And we're back.
We're back.
Oh.
Great.
Good.
So we just took a nice break for dinner.
Had a nice dinner.
For a birthday dinner.
For me.
Happy birthday, Josh.
Thank you, Daniel.
How do you feel?
Full.
Good.
But good. Full and good.
We went to one of our sponsors' restaurants, Chinese Tuxedo on Doyer Street.
We were treated to the full menu of deliciousness and wait staff. And
it was fantastic. There were probably like 9 wait staff that were consistently leaning over Josh's shoulder and surprising him with
scaring
kinds of food. Yeah.
It was a veritable Temple of Doom in there.
Yep. Oof. Okay.
What, bad?
Because
they were eating snakes and shit.
Yeah.
Shit, I can't say shit.
Yeah. That's okay. Anyway, point being, happy 36.
Thanks, Dan.
You're halfway done.
Oh, my God. I assume I'll live at least to 150. I mean, come on.
Good.
Let's be realistic.
How many more seasons of Snubs is that?
Depends how many we do per year, which at this rate is...
At this rate, we will literally never run out of material. Cool. Well, thank you for joining us for the return of Snubs. And we'll tune in next week for our final episode, which will be the award ceremony, fake award ceremony.
Oh, wow. I'm very excited.
Where Terminator, Karate Kid, Ghostbusters, and Temple of Doom will duke it out for the title.
It's going to be intense.
Best popular film from 1984.
It's
going to
be intense. We don't know what it's going to be yet.
No, I don't think that we do.
And we're not going to talk about it. All we're going to do is stop recording and then start recording.
All right.
And then talk about it.
That sounds good.
All right, everybody.
Cool.
Have a great few seconds. Talk to you soon.
We'll be right back.